He came back into the room, slippers whispering. He held two green plastic glasses that looked like the premiums they sometimes gave out at gas station openings. When you filled your tank, you got a free glass. Dusander thrust a glass at Todd. I lived adequately on the stock portfolio this Dufresne had set up for me. For the first 5 years I was here. But then I sold my diamond match stock in order to buy this house and a small cottage not far from Big Sur. Then inflation, recession. I sold the cottage, and one by one I sold the stocks, many of them at fantastic profits. I wish to God I had bought more. But I thought I was well protected in other directions. The stocks were, as you Americans say, a flyer. He made a toothless, hissing sound and snapped his fingers. Todd was bored. He had not come here to listen to Dusander whine about his money or mutter about his stocks. The thought of blackmailing Dusander had never even crossed Todd's mind. Money? What would he do with it? He had his allowance. He had his paper route. If his monetary needs went higher than what these could provide during any given week, there was always someone who needed his lawn mowed. Todd lifted his milk to his lips and then hesitated. His smile shone out again, an admiring smile. He extended the gas station premium glass to Dusander. You have some of it, he said slyly. Dusander stared at him for a moment, uncomprehending, and then rolled his bloodshot eyes. Goose got! He took the glass, swallowed twice, and handed it back. No gasping for breath, no clawing at the throat, no smell of bitter almonds. It is milk, boy, milk from the Dairy Lee Farms. On the carton is a picture of a smiling cow. Todd watched him warily for a moment, then took a small sip. Yes, it tasted like milk, sure did. But somehow he didn't feel very thirsty anymore. He put the glass down. Dusander shrugged, raised his own glass, and took a swallow. He smacked his lips over it. Schnapps? Todd asked. Bourbon, ancient age, very nice and cheap. Todd fiddled his fingers along the seams of his jeans. So, Dusander said, if you decided to have a flyer of your own, you should be aware that you have picked a worthless stock. Huh? Blackmail, Dusander said. Isn't that what they call it on Mannix and Hawaii 5-0 and Barnaby Jones? Extortion. If that was what... But Todd was laughing. Hearty, boyish laughter. He shook his head, tried to speak, could not, and went on laughing. No, Dusander said. And suddenly he looked gray, and more frightened than he had since he and Todd had begun to speak. He took another large swallow of his drink, grimaced and shuddered. I see that is not it, at least not the extortion of money. But though you laugh, I smell extortion in it somewhere. What is it? Why do you come here and disturb an old man? Perhaps, as you say, I was once a Nazi, SS even. Now I am only old, and to have a bowel movement I have to use a suppository. So what do you want? Todd had sobered again. He stared at Dusander with an open and appealing frankness. Why, I want to hear about it. That's all. That's all I want, really. Hear about it? Dusander echoed. He looked utterly perplexed. Todd leaned forward, tanned elbows on blue jean knees. Sure. The firing squads, the gas chambers, the ovens, the guys who had to dig their own graves and then stand on the end so they'd fall into them, his tongue came out and wetted his lips, the examinations, the experiments, everything, all the gushy stuff. Dusander stared at him with a certain amazed detachment, the way a veterinarian might stare at a cat who was giving birth to a succession of two-headed kittens. You are a monster, he said softly. Todd sniffed. According to the books I read for my report, you're the monster, Mr. Dusander, not me. You sent them to the ovens, not me. 2,000 a day at Patton before you came, 3,000 after, 3,500 before the Russians came and made you stop. Himmler called you an efficiency expert and gave you a medal. So you call me a monster. Oh, boy. All of that is a filthy American lie, Dusander said, stung. He set his glass down with a bang, slopping bourbon onto his hand and the table. The problem was not of my making, nor was the solution. I was given orders and directives, which I followed. Todd's smile widened. It was now almost a smirk. Oh, I know how the Americans have distorted that, Dusander muttered. But your own politicians make our Dr. Goebbels look like a child playing with picture books in a kindergarten. They speak of morality while they douse screaming children and old women in burning napalm. Your draft resistors are called cowards and peaceniks. For refusing to follow orders, they are either put in jails or scourged from the country. Those who demonstrate against this country's unfortunate Asian adventure are clubbed down in the streets. The GI soldiers who kill the innocent are decorated by presidents welcomed home from the bayoneting of children and the burning of hospitals with parades and bunting. They are given dinners, keys to the city, free tickets to pro football games. He toasted his glass in Todd's direction. Only those who lose are tried as war criminals for following orders and directives. He drank, and then had a coughing fit that brought thin color to his cheeks. Through most of this, Todd fidgeted the way he did when his parents discussed whatever had been on the news that night. Good old Walter Klondike, his dad called him. He didn't care about Dusander's politics any more than he cared about Dusander's stocks. His idea was that people made up politics so they could do things. Like when he wanted to feel around under Sharon Ackerman's dress last year. Sharon said it was bad for him to want to do that, even though he could tell from her tone of voice that the idea sort of excited her. So he told her he wanted to be a doctor when he grew up, and then she let him. That was politics. He wanted to hear about German doctors trying to mate women with dogs, putting identical twins into refrigerators to see whether they would die at the same time or if one of them would last longer, and electroshock therapy, and operations without anesthetic, and German soldiers raping all the women they wanted. The rest was just so much tired bullspit to cover up the gushy stuff after someone came along and put a stop to it. If I hadn't followed orders, I would have been dead. Dusander was breathing hard, his upper body rocking back and forth in the chair, making the springs squeak. A little cloud of liquor smell hung around him. There was always the Russian front, nicht wahr? Our leaders were madmen, granted, but does one argue with madmen, especially when the maddest of them all has the luck of Satan? He escaped a brilliant assassination attempt by inches. Those who conspired were strangled with piano wire, strangled slowly. Their death agonies were filmed for the edification of the elite. Yeah, neat, Todd cried impulsively. Did you see that movie? Yes, I saw. We all saw what happened to those unwilling or unable to run before the wind and wait for the storm to end. What we did then was the right thing. For that time and that place, it was the right thing. I would do it again, but... His eyes dropped to the glass. It was empty. But I don't wish to speak of it, or even think of it. What we did was motivated only by survival, and nothing about survival is pretty. I had dreams. He slowly took a cigarette from the box on the TV. Yes, for years I had them. Blackness. And sounds in the blackness. Tractor engines, bulldozer engines. Gun butts thudding against what might have been frozen earth or human skulls. Whistles, sirens, pistol shots, screams. The doors of cattle cars rumbling open on cold winter afternoons. Then, in my dreams, all sounds would stop, and eyes would open in the dark, gleaming like the eyes of animals in a rainforest. For many years I lived on the edge of the jungle, and I suppose that is why it is always the jungle I smelled and felt in those dreams. When I woke from them, I would be drenched with sweat, my heart thundering in my chest, my hands stuffed into my mouth to stifle the screams, and I would think, the dream is the truth. Brazil, Paraguay, Cuba, those places are the dream. In the reality, I am still at Patin. The Russians are closer today than yesterday. Some of them are remembering that in 1943 they had to eat frozen German corpses to stay alive. Now they long to drink hot German blood. There were rumors, boy, that some of them did just that when they crossed into Germany. Cut the throats of some prisoners and drank their blood out of a boot. I would wake up and think the work must go on, if only so there is no evidence of what we did here, or so little that the world which doesn't want to believe it won't have to. I would think the work must go on if we are to survive. Todd listened to this with close attention and great interest. This was pretty good, but he was sure there would be better stuff in the days ahead. All Dusander needed was a little prodding. Heck, he was lucky. Lots of men his age were senile. Dusander dragged deeply on his cigarette. Later, after the dreams went away, there were days when I would think I had seen someone from Patin. Never guards or fellow officers, always inmates. I remember one afternoon in West Germany 10 years ago. There was an accident on the Autobahn. Traffic was frozen in every lane. I sat in my Morris listening to the radio, waiting for the traffic to move. I looked to my right. There was a very old Simca in the next lane, and the man behind the wheel was looking at me. He was perhaps 50. He looked ill. There was a scar on his cheek. His hair was white, short, cut badly. I looked away. The minutes passed, and still the traffic didn't move. I began snatching glances at the man in the Simca. Every time I did, he was looking at me, his face as still as death, his eyes sunken in their sockets. I became convinced he had been at Patin. He had been there and had recognized me. Dusander wiped a hand across his eyes. It was winter. The man was wearing an overcoat. But I was convinced that if I got out of my car and went to him, made him take off his coat and push up his shirt sleeves, I would see the number on his arm. At last the traffic began to move again. I pulled away from the Simca. If the jam had lasted another 10 minutes, I believe I would have gotten out of my car and pulled the old man out of his. I would have beaten him, number or no number. I would have beaten him for looking at me that way. Shortly after that, I left Germany forever. Lucky for you, Todd said. Dusander shrugged. It was the same everywhere. Havana, Mexico City, Rome. I was in Rome for 3 years. You know, I would see a man looking at me over his cappuccino in a cafe. A woman in a hotel lobby who seemed more interested in me than in her magazine. A waiter in a restaurant who would keep glancing at me no matter whom he was serving. I would become convinced that these people were studying me. And that night, the dream would come. The sounds. The jungle. The eyes. But when I came to America, I put it out of my mind. I go to movies. I eat out once a week, always at one of those fast food places that are so clean and so well lighted by fluorescent bars. Here at my house I do jigsaw puzzles and I read novels, most of them bad ones, and watch TV. At night I drink until I'm sleepy. The dreams don't come anymore. When I see someone looking at me in the supermarket or the library or the tobacconist's, I think it must be because I look like their grandfather, or an old teacher or a neighbor in a town they left some years ago. He shook his head at Todd. Whatever happened at Patin, it happened to another man, not to me. Great, Todd said. I want to hear all about it. Dusander's eyes squeezed closed and then opened slowly. You don't understand. I do not wish to speak of it. You will, though. If you don't, I'll tell everyone who you are. Dusanda stared at him, grey-faced. I knew, he said, that I would find extortion sooner or later. Today I want to hear about the gas ovens, Tod said, how you baked them after they were dead. His smile beamed out, rich and radiant. But put your teeth in before you start. You look better with your teeth in. Dusanda did as he was told. He talked to Tod about the gas ovens until Tod had to go home for lunch. Every time he tried to slip over into generalities, Tod would frown severely and ask him specific questions to get him back on the track. Dusanda drank a great deal as he talked. He didn't smile. Tod smiled. Tod smiled enough for both of them. 2. August 1974. They sat on Dusander's back porch under a cloudless, smiling sky. Tod was wearing jeans, Keds, and his little league shirt. Dusanda was wearing a baggy gray shirt and shapeless khaki pants held up with suspenders. Wino pants, Tod thought with private contempt. They looked like they had come straight from a box in the back of the Salvation Army store downtown. He was really going to have to do something about the way Dusanda dressed when he was at home. It spoiled some of the fun. The two of them were eating Big Macs that Tod had brought in his bike basket, pedaling fast so they wouldn't get cold. Tod was sipping a Coke through a plastic straw. Dusanda had a glass of bourbon. His old man's voice rose and fell, papery, hesitant, sometimes nearly inaudible. His faded blue eyes threaded with the usual snaps of red were never still. An observer might have thought them grandfather and grandson, the latter perhaps attending some rite of passage, a handing down. And that's all I remember, Dusanda finished presently, and took a large bite of his sandwich. McDonald's secret sauce dribbled down his chin. You can do better than that, Tod said softly. Dusanda took a large swallow from his glass. The uniforms were made of paper, he said finally, almost snarling. When one inmate died, the uniform was passed on if it could still be worn. Sometimes one paper uniform could dress as many as 40 inmates. I received high marks for my frugality. From Glück's? From Himmler. But there was a clothing factory in Patton. You told me that just last week. Why didn't you have the uniforms made there? The inmates themselves could have made them. The job of the factory in Patton was to make uniforms for German soldiers. And as for us, Dusander's voice faltered for a moment, and then he forced himself to go on. We were not in the business of rehabilitation, he finished. Tod smiled his broad smile. Enough for today, please. My throat is sore. You shouldn't smoke so much then, Tod said, continuing to smile. Tell me some more about the uniforms. Which? Inmate or SS? Dusander's voice was resigned. Smiling, Tod said, both. 3. September 1974. Tod was in the kitchen of his house, making himself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You got to the kitchen by going up half a dozen redwood steps to a raised area that gleamed with chrome and stainless steel. His mother's electric typewriter had been going steadily ever since Tod had gotten home from school. She was typing a master's thesis for a grad student. The grad student had short hair, wore thick glasses, and looked like a creature from outer space, in Todd's humble opinion. The thesis was on the effect of fruit flies in the Salinas Valley after World War II, or some good shit like that. Now her typewriter stopped, and she came out of her office. Tod, baby, she greeted him. Monica, baby, he hailed back, amiably enough. His mother wasn't a bad-looking chick for 36, Tod thought. Blonde hair that was streaked ash in a couple of places, tall, shapely, now dressed in dark red shorts and a sheer blouse of a warm, whiskey color. The blouse was casually knotted below her breasts, putting her flat, unlined midriff on show. A typewriter eraser was tucked into her hair, which had been pinned carelessly back with a turquoise clip. So how's school? She asked him, coming up the steps into the kitchen. She brushed his lips casually with hers and then slid onto one of the stools in front of the breakfast counter. School's cool. Going to be on the honor roll again? Sure. Actually, he thought his grades might slip a notch this first quarter. He had been spending a lot of time with Dusander, and when he wasn't actually with the old Kraut, he was thinking about the things Dusander had told him. Once or twice he had dreamed about the things Dusander had told him, but it was nothing he couldn't handle. "Apt pupil," she said, ruffling his shaggy blonde hair. "How's that sandwich?" "Good," he said. "Would you make me one and bring it into my office?" "Can't," he said, getting up. "I promised Mr. Denker I'd come over and read to him for an hour or so." "Are you still on Robinson Crusoe?" "Nope." He showed her the spine of a thick book he had bought in a junk shop for 20 cents. "Tom Jones."
"Ye gods and little fishes, it'll take you the whole school year to get through that," Todd baby.
"Couldn't you at least find an abridged edition like with Crusoe?"
"Probably, but he wanted to hear all of this one. He said so."
"Oh." She looked at him for a moment, then hugged him. It was rare for her to be so demonstrative, and it made Todd a little uneasy. "You're a peach to be taking so much of your spare time to read to him. Your father and I think it's just exceptional." Todd cast his eyes down modestly.
"And to not want to tell anybody," she said,
"hiding your light under a bushel."
"Oh, the kids I hang around with, they'd probably think I was some kind of weirdo," Todd said, smiling modestly down at the floor. "All that good shit."
"Don't say that," she admonished absently. Then, "Do you think Mr. Denker would like to come over and have dinner with us some night?"
"Maybe," Todd said vaguely.
"Listen, I gotta put an egg in my shoe and beat it."
"Okay. Supper at 6:30, don't forget."
"I won't."
"Your father's gotta work late, so it'll just be me and thee again, okay?"
"Crazy, baby." She watched him go with a fond smile, hoping there was nothing in Tom Jones he shouldn't be reading. He was only 13. She didn't suppose there was. He was growing up in a society where magazines like Penthouse were available to anyone with a dollar and a quarter, or to any kid who could reach up to the top shelf of the magazine rack and grab a quick peek before the clerk could shout for him to put that up and get lost. In a society that seemed to believe most of all in the creed of hump thy neighbor, she didn't think there could be much in a book 200 years old to screw up Todd's head, although she supposed the old man might get off on it a little. And, as Richard liked to say, for a kid, the whole world's a laboratory. You have to let them poke around in it. And if the kid in question has a healthy home life and loving parents, he'll be all the stronger for having knocked around a few strange corners. And there went the healthiest kid she knew, pedaling up the street on a Schwinn. We did okay by the lad, she thought, turning to make her sandwich. Damned if we didn't do okay. 4. October 1974. Dusander had lost weight. They sat in the kitchen, the shop-worn copy of Tom Jones between them on the oilcloth-covered table. Todd, who tried never to miss a trick, had purchased the Cliff's notes on the book with part of his allowance and had carefully read the entire summary against the possibility that his mother or father might ask him questions about the plot. Todd was eating a ringding he had bought at the market. He had bought one for Dusander, but Dusander hadn't touched it. He only looked at it morosely from time to time as he drank his bourbon. Todd hated to see anything as tasty as ringdings go to waste. If he didn't eat it pretty quick, Todd was going to ask him if he could have it.
"So how did the stuff get to Patton?"
he asked Dusander.
"In railroad cars," Dusander said. "In railroad cars labeled medical supplies. It came in long crates that looked like coffins. Fitting, I suppose. The inmates offloaded the crates and stacked them in the infirmary. Later, our own men stacked them in the storage sheds. They did it at night. The storage sheds were behind the showers."
"Was it always Cyclone B?"
"No. From time to time, it would be sent something else. Experimental gases. The High Command was always interested in improving efficiency. Once they sent us a gas codenamed Pegasus. A nerve gas. Thank God they never sent it again. It..." Dusander saw Todd lean forward, saw those eyes sharpen, and he suddenly stopped and gestured casually with his gas station premium glass. "It didn't work very well," he said. "It was quite boring." But Todd was not fooled, not in the least.
"What did it do?"
"It killed them. What did you think it did? Made them walk on water? It killed them, that's all."
"Tell me."
"No," Dusander said, now unable to hide the horror he felt.
He hadn't thought of Pegasus in how long, 10 years, 20? I won't tell you. I refuse. Tell me, Todd repeated, licking chocolate icing from his fingers. Tell me, or you know what. Yes, Dusanda thought. I know what, indeed I do, you putrid little monster.
It made them dance, he said reluctantly.
Dance?
Like the Cyclone B, it came in through the shower heads, and they began to leap about. Some were screaming, most of them were laughing. They began to vomit and to defecate helplessly.
Wow, Todd said. Shit themselves, huh?
He pointed at the ringding on Dusander's plate. He had finished his own.
You going to eat that?
Dusander didn't reply. His eyes were hazed with memory. His face was far away and cold, like the dark side of a planet which does not rotate. Inside his mind he felt the queerest combination of revulsion and, could it be, nostalgia? They began to twitch all over and to make high, strange sounds in their throat. My men, they called Pegasus the yodeling gas. At last they all collapsed and just lay there on the floor in their own filth. They lay there, yes, they lay there on the concrete, screaming and yodeling with bloody noses. But I lied, boy. The gas didn't kill them, either because it wasn't strong enough or because we couldn't bring ourselves to wait long enough. I suppose it was that. Men and women like that could not have lived long. Finally, I sent in 5 men with rifles to end their agonies. It would have looked bad on my record if it had shown up. I've no doubt of that. It would have looked like a waste of cartridges at a time when the Fuhrer had declared every cartridge a national resource. But those 5 men I trusted. There were times, boy, when I thought I would never forget the sound they made. The yodeling sound, the laughing.
Yeah, I bet, Todd said.
He finished Dusander's ringding in 2 bites. Waste not, want not, Todd's mother said, on the rare occasions when Todd complained about leftovers.
That was a good story, Mr. Dusander. You always tell them good once I get you going.
Todd smiled at him, and incredibly, certainly not, because he wanted to. Dusander found himself smiling back. 5. November 1974. Dick Bowden, Todd's father, looked remarkably like a movie and TV actor named Lloyd Bochner. He, Bowden, not Bochner, was 38. He was a thin, narrow man who liked to dress in Ivy League-style shirts and solid-color suits, usually dark. When he was on a construction site, he wore khakis and a hard hat. That was a souvenir of his Peace Corps days, when he had helped to design and build 2 dams in Africa. When he was working in his study at home, he wore half-glasses that had a way of slipping down to the end of his nose and making him look like a college dean. He was wearing those glasses now as he tapped his son's first quarter report card against his desk's gleaming glass top. 1B, 4 C's, 1D. A D, for Christ's sake, Todd. Your mother's not showing it, but she's really upset. Todd dropped his eyes. He didn't smile. When his dad swore, that wasn't exactly the best of news.
My God, you've never gotten a report card like this. A D in beginning algebra? What is this?
I don't know, Dad. He looked humbly at his knees.
Your mother and I think that maybe you've been spending a little too much time with Mr. Denker, not hitting the books enough. We think you ought to cut it down to weekends, Slugger. At least until we see where you're going academically.
Todd looked up, and for a single second Bowden thought he saw a wild, pallid anger in his son's eyes. His own eyes widened, his fingers clenched on Todd's buff-colored report card. And then it was just Todd, looking at him openly, if rather unhappily. Had that anger really been there? Surely not. But the moment had unsettled him, made it hard for him to know exactly how to proceed. Todd hadn't been mad.
And Dick Bowden didn't want to make him mad. He and his son were friends, always had been friends, and Dick wanted things to stay that way. They had no secrets from each other, none at all. Except for the fact that Dick Bowden was sometimes unfaithful with his secretary, but that wasn't exactly the sort of thing you told your 13-year-old son, was it? And besides, that had absolutely no bearing on his home life, his family life. That was the way it was supposed to be, the way it had to be, in a cockamamie world where murderers went unpunished, high school kids skin-popped heroin, and junior high schoolers kids Todd's age turned up with VD. No, Dad, please don't do that. I mean, don't punish Mr. Denker for something that's my fault. I mean, he'd be lost without me. I'll do better, really. That algebra, it just threw me to start with. But I went over to Ben Tremaine's, and after we studied together for a few days, I started to get it. I don't know, I sort of choked at first. I think you're spending too much time with him, Bowden said, but he was weakening. It was hard to refuse Todd, hard to disappoint him. And what he said about punishing the old man for Todd's falling off, God damn it, it made sense. The old man looked forward to his visit so much. That Mr. Storman, the algebra teacher, is really hard, Todd said. Lots of kids got D's. 3 or 4 got F's. Bowden nodded thoughtfully. I won't go Wednesdays anymore, not until I bring my grades up. He had read his father's eyes. And instead of going out for anything at school, I'll stay after every day and study, I promise. You really like the old guy that much. He's really neat, Todd said sincerely. Well, okay, we'll try it your way, slugger. But I want to see a big improvement in your marks come January, you understand me? I'm thinking of your future. You may think junior high is too young to start thinking about that, but it's not. Not by a long chalk. As his mother liked to say, waste not, want not, so Dick Bowden liked to say, not by a long chalk. I understand, Dad, Todd said gravely. Man-to-man stuff. Get out of here and give those books a workout, then. He pushed his half-glasses up on his nose and clapped Todd on the shoulder. Todd's smile, broad and bright, broke across his face. Right on, Dad. Bowden watched Todd go, with a prideful smile of his own. One in a million. And that hadn't been anger on Todd's face, for sure. Pique, maybe. But not that high-voltage emotion he had at first thought he'd seen there. If Todd was that mad, he would have known. He could read his son like a book. It had always been that way. Whistling, his fatherly duty discharged, Dick Bowden unrolled a blueprint and bent over it. 6. December 1974. The face that came in answer to Todd's insistent finger on the bell was haggard and yellowed. The hair, which had been lush in July, had now begun to recede from the bony brow. It looked lusterless and brittle. Dussander's body, thin to begin with, was now gaunt. Although Todd thought he was nowhere near as gaunt as the inmates who had once been delivered into his hands. Todd's left hand had been behind his back when Dussander came to the door. Now he brought it out and handed a wrapped package to Dussander. "Merry Christmas!" he yelled. Dussander had cringed from the box. Now he took it with no expression of pleasure or surprise. He handled it gingerly, as if it might contain explosive. Beyond the porch it was raining. It had been raining on and off for almost a week, and Todd had carried the box inside his coat. It was wrapped in gay foil and ribbon. "What is it?" Dussander asked without enthusiasm as they went to the kitchen. "Open it and see." Todd took a can of Coke from his jacket pocket and put it on the red and white checked oilcloth that covered the kitchen table. "Better pull down the shades," he said confidentially. Distrust immediately leaked onto Dussander's face. "Oh, why?" "Well, you can never tell who's looking," Todd said, smiling. "Isn't that how you got along all these years? By seeing the people who might be looking before they saw you?" Dussander pulled down the kitchen shades. Then he poured himself a glass of bourbon. Then he pulled the bow off the package. Todd had wrapped it the way boys so often wrap Christmas packages, boys who have more important things on their minds, things like football and street hockey and the Friday night creature feature you'll watch with a friend who's sleeping over, the two of you wrapped in a blanket and crammed together on one end of the couch, laughing. There were a lot of ragged corners, a lot of uneven seams, a lot of scotch tape. It spoke of impatience with such a womanly thing. Dusander was a little touched, in spite of himself. And later, when the horror had receded a little, he thought, I should have known. It was a uniform, an SS uniform, complete with jackboots. He looked numbly from the contents of the box to its cardboard cover, Peter's Quality Costume Clothiers, at the same location since 1951.
No, he said softly. I won't put it on. This is where it ends, boy. I'll die before I put it on.
Remember what they did to Eichmann, Todd said solemnly. He was an old man, and he had no politics. Isn't that what you said? Besides, I saved the whole fall for it. It cost over $80 with the boots thrown in. You didn't mind wearing it in 1944 either, not at all.
You little bastard!
Dusander raised one fist over his head. Todd didn't flinch at all. He stood his ground, eyes shining.
Yeah, he said softly. Go ahead and touch me. You just touch me once.
Dusander lowered the hand. His lips were quivering.
You are a fiend from hell, he muttered.
Put it on, Todd invited. Dusander's hands went to the tie of his robe and paused there. His eyes, sheep-like and begging, looked into Todd's.
Please, he said. I am an old man. No more.
Todd shook his head slowly but firmly. His eyes were still shining. He liked it when Dusander begged, the way they must have begged him once, the inmates at Patin. Dusander let the robe fall to the floor and stood naked except for his slippers and his boxer shorts. His chest was sunken, his belly slightly bloated. His arms were scrawny, old man's arms. But the uniform, Todd thought, the uniform will make a difference. Slowly, Dusander took the tunic out of the box and began to put it on. 10 minutes later, he stood fully dressed in the SS uniform. The cap was slightly askew, the shoulders slumped, but still the death's head insignia stood out clearly. Dusander had a dark dignity, at least in Todd's eyes, that he had not possessed earlier. In spite of his slump, in spite of the cockeyed angle of his feet, Todd was pleased. For the first time, Dusander looked to Todd as Todd believed he should look. Older, yes, defeated, certainly, but in uniform again. Not an old man spinning away his sunset years watching Lawrence Welk on a cruddy black-and-white TV with tinfoil on the rabbit ears, but Kurt Dusander, the blood fiend of Patin. As for Dusander, he felt disgust, discomfort, and a mild, sneaking sense of relief. He partly despised this latter emotion, recognizing it as the truest indicator yet of the psychological domination the boy had established over him. He was the boy's prisoner, and every time he found he could live through yet another indignity, every time he felt that mild relief, the boy's power grew.